Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting an accusation of complicity by Russia's leader in a murder case in London. President Vladimir Putin probably approved the plan by Russia's FSB security service to kill a former agent-turned-Kremlin critic who died after drinking tea laced with radioactive poison. That is according to a British judge Thursday in a strongly worded report that led Moscow to accuse Britain of a politically motivated attack. Judge Robert Owen, who led a public inquiry into the 2006 killing of Alexander Litvinenko, said he was certain that two Russian men had given Litvinenko tea containing a fatal dose of polonium-210 during a meeting at a London hotel. He said there was a strong probability that Russia's FSB, the successor to the Soviet Union's KGB, directed the killing and that the operation was probably approved by Putin, then as now the president of Russia. On his deathbed, Litvinenko accused Putin of ordering his killing. Britain summoned the Russian ambassador for a dressing down Thursday and imposed an asset freeze on the two main Russian suspects. British Home Secretary Theresa May spoke to the Parliament in London.
The government takes these findings extremely seriously, as I am sure does every member of this House. We are carefully considering the report's findings in detail and their implications. In particular, the conclusion that the Russian state was probably involved in the murder of Mr. Litvinenko is deeply disturbing. Yeah. It goes without saying that this was a blatant and unacceptable breach of the most fundamental tenets of international law.
Moscow has always strongly denied being involved. VOA News. Dominic Ongwen's confirmation of charges hearing at the International Criminal Court, which will determine if there is sufficient evidence for a trial, has once again brought the conversation of justice and peace in northern Uganda to the forefront. Elizabeth Pollard reports from Kampala.
The case of Dominic Ongwen has divided many on the meaning of justice and reconciliation. Ongwen is seen as both a victim and a perpetrator. Abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army at only 10 years old, he joined the ranks of thousands of other child soldiers. But over time, Ongwen managed to rise through the ranks of the LRA, carrying out multiple attacks and working his way into Joseph Kony's inner circle. Ongwen surrendered himself in the Central African Republic in January of 2015, and soon after, he was transferred to the ICC. Ongwen's pre-trial hearing is expected to last 3 to 5 days. If the court finds there is sufficient evidence, the case is expected to go to trial. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Plunging oil prices have roiled world stock markets in the first few weeks of this year, but U.S. Treasury's chief, Jack Lew, says cheap oil is benefiting consumers across the globe. Thursday, Lew told the annual World Economic Forum at the Swiss ski resort in Davos that the crude oil now below $27 a barrel in the world market. Consumers have more money in their pockets to buy products they need or improve their household finances by paying down debt or saving. He said low prices do not have to be bad for the overall global economy. Lew said the slowdown in Chinese economic growth, the other main factor in the world stock market turmoil, was not a surprise, but he said it shows Beijing needs to press ahead with a long and difficult transition to change the Chinese economy from focusing on exports to a more consumer-driven economy. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says that international peace talks on Syria's future that were supposed to begin Monday could be delayed by a day or two. Kerry made the comments Thursday on the sidelines of an economic forum in Davos, Switzerland. He arrived in Davos late Wednesday and met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Afterwards, Lavrov and Moscow has no intention to postpone the negotiations until next month. Kerry also met with UN envoy for Syria, Stephane de Mistura. And the World Health Organization said Thursday a second person has Ebola in Sierra Leone, where an outbreak of the virus had been declared over in November. The first case was reported last week when Ebola was detected in the body of a woman who became ill and died on January 12th. A WHO spokesman said now the woman's aunt, who served as the primary caregiver, had tested positive. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN warns that refugee women and children seeking safety in Europe are at great risk of sexual abuse and violence throughout their journey. An assessment mission conducted by the UN Refugee Agency, UN Population Fund, and the Women's Refugee Commission finds measures to protect the women and girls are inadequate.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the AU has expressed hope that serious peace talks will begin in Burundi and that Burundi's government will agree to the deployment of peacekeepers. And former senior commander in the Lord's Resistance Army appears before the International Criminal Court today.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Angola, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, UN Security Council members are scheduled to arrive in Burundi late today. They'll try to ease political tensions, fueling escalating violence. Hundreds of people have died since April when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. About 250,000 Burundians have fled to neighboring countries. The UN, US, and others fear tensions could take on an ethnic dimension. The AU is voicing its support for the UN ambassador's visit. The AU has expressed what it calls its fervent hope that serious peace talks will begin and that Burundi's government will agree to the deployment of peacekeepers. President Nkurunziza has expressed strong opposition and said UN troops would be considered invaders. Nevertheless, a senior advisor to the president, Willie Nyamitwe, says his government welcomes the UN visit. He says the delegation will see for itself that Burundi is calm as it tries to disarm individuals who threaten peace in the country. Nyamitwe says people have already started talking to each other through the inter-Burundian dialogue. The dialogue is overseen by a national commission.
Charge 1 to charge 10 concerns crimes in relation.
A former senior commander in the Lord's Resistance Army, Dominic Ongwen, appeared before the International Criminal Court today. Judges at the Hague Court are to decide if there's enough evidence to try him for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity. If they do, this would be the first time an LRA leader faces international justice. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
Charge 1 to charge 10 concerns crimes in relation to the attack.
The list of charges against ex-LRA commander Dominic Ongwen is so long that presiding judge Kuno Tarfusser opted to summarize the 70 counts against him rather than having them read out. Asked whether he understood the charges, Ongwen, looking very focused and dressed in a sharp gray suit, responded positively, speaking in northern Uganda's Acholi dialect through an interpreter.
Well, from my point of view, whether the charges are read or not read, it's all going to be a waste of time. You may speak 5 words and only 2 issues are correct. You may speak 10 words and only 2 things are correct.
Ongwen faces charges of murder, rape, torture, forced marriage, and using child soldiers related to his alleged involvement in a string of LRA attacks against civilians in northern Uganda between 2002 and 2005.
The huts in which the inhabitants lived were thatched with grass.
Calling the defendant the tip of the spear of the rebel group, prosecutor Benjamin Gumpert showed Ugandan army footage in the aftermath of one LRA raid Ongwen was allegedly involved in, with bodies in makeshift graves and flies buzzing around. He said Ongwen played a key role in operations crucial for LRA's continued existence, abducting children to be used as sex slaves or child soldiers.
They were regularly required to participate not only in the murderous attacks on civilian camps, but in individual acts of torture and murder designed to convince recently abducted children that they were so steeped in blood that there could be no acceptance for them back in civilian society.
In some ways, that seems to be Ongwen's story. Now about 40, he was reportedly abducted as a child by the LRA in Uganda, and he rose the ranks. But Prosecutor Gumpert argued that trauma does not absolve him of his alleged crimes, although it may factor into his sentencing if he's brought to trial and found guilty. The LRA has had a brutal record of massacring, mutilating, raping, and kidnapping tens of thousands of civilians in Uganda, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Central African Republic in its three-decade existence. The ICC also has an arrest warrant out for the group's fugitive head, Joseph Kony. Rights groups like Human Rights Watch are hailing the ICC hearing. Liz Evanson is senior counsel for HRW in Brussels.
This case against Dominic Ongwen is really the first of its kind, the first time that a court is getting to hear allegations of crimes committed by the Lord's Resistance Army, and where victims may have the opportunity to find out the truth of what happened.
The defense will have a chance to make its case later in the hearing, which runs until next week. Defense lawyers want the case thrown out. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Members of the Democratic Party in the U.S. Senate blocked passage of a bill yesterday that would have required tougher background checks on Syrian and Iraqi refugees entering the United States. The American Security Against Foreign Enemies Act was passed by the House of Representatives in November in the aftermath of the Paris attacks. The House bill passed despite President Barack Obama's opposition.
The UN warns that refugee women and children seeking safety in Europe are at great risk of sexual abuse and violence throughout their journey. An assessment mission conducted by the UN Refugee Agency, UN Population Fund, and the Women's Refugee Commission finds measures to protect the women and girls are inadequate. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The joint field mission was carried out in Greece and Macedonia in November. It found those most at risk of sexual abuse and violence include single women traveling alone or with children, pregnant and lactating women, adolescent girls, unaccompanied children, and early married children. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler tells VOA it is difficult to know how widespread the phenomenon is because women are reluctant to speak about their experiences. But he says it is feared the abuse to which they are subjected along the European migratory route is vastly underreported. He says women describe being forced to engage in transactional sex to pay for travel documents on their journey. He says women fall prey to smugglers who demand a hefty price for transporting refugees and migrants across the Mediterranean Sea to Europe.
In some cases, women have been put under pressure to perform sex with the smugglers in order to be allowed to continue. There have also been cases in which women, girls and boys, have lost their money, and therefore the only way that they can continue with the journey, find the money to continue with the journey, is through selling themselves for money.
Spindler says there also are reports of women being sexually abused by other refugees and migrants, and in some cases by officials in countries of transit. He says small boys traveling alone also have been forced to perform sex by smugglers so they can continue their journeys. He says women and children are exposed to many dangers in overcrowded reception facilities or transit centers. He says simple measures such as providing separate toilets for men and women and ensuring well-lit and gender-separated sleeping facilities could reduce the potential risks. Aid agencies are calling for action by European Union governments to protect refugee women and children from the dangers and exploitation facing them and to prosecute the perpetrators of these crimes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders alleges that barbed wire fences and substandard conditions in detention camps in Italy and Greece are intended to deter migrants from reaching European havens. VOA's David Arnold spoke to MSF humanitarian coordinator Aurelie Panthu about the allegations and her visits to refugee centers in Europe.
I have visited several ones in Greece. Some of them are closed today because conditions were so bad they at the end they closed. But it's basically big barracks. Most of the time these buildings were used as military schools or military bases. People were kept in big cells, overcrowded cells, very limited access to the outside. So they had, for example, 1 hour in the morning, 1 hour in the afternoon to go out and get some fresh air. Medical care was not provided most of the time in these places, so it was the police who had to decide who was sick enough to be brought to the hospital. So you can imagine the medical impact this type of situation. We were witnessing a lot of mental health distress, self-harming, suicide attempts, and people were kept in this condition without basic hygiene. I mean, the conditions, the toilets were most of the time broken. There was no heating system. There was no hot water. And people were kept for up to 18 months.
What kind of services have been offered in place of them?
The actual government had publicly said that they wanted to move away from this detention policy. And detention in Greece was used in the past as deterrent, was clearly used, you know, to tell people, don't come here, you will be detained in horrible conditions. And now we're starting to see again, you know, an increased resort to detention, which is very worrying.
When you talk about fences, barbed wire fences, Hungary built one of the largest. Have you seen it?
Yes, we were actually providing assistance at the border before the fence was built. So we had people who were crossing from Serbia to Hungary benefiting from our medical services. And we had to shift our response because when the fence was built, the route shifted immediately in a matter of a few days toward Croatia. So we had to actually close our project and reopen another one at the border with Croatia. This clearly shows that you can build as many fences as you want. What will happen is that people will come anyway. They will just use another route.
You mentioned earlier that migration has been occurring that you observed for the last 15 years. Has Europe learned anything about how to handle the migrants in a better fashion than they have in the last year?
Well, what 2015 has shown is that they have learned no lesson at all, because the response is still focusing on deterrence and building fences. There's no collective response. There is no political willingness to invest in, you know, in receiving these people in a decent way. And I would say that Europe has not learned its lesson at all, because they keep on thinking they can prevent people fleeing conflicts and persecutions, human rights violations, from seeking safety to Europe. This is something that that is not happening just with border guard and fences. I mean, these people, they, you know, to have conditions in their home countries to significantly improve, consider staying that and there. And the problem is that these policies have been only, you know, increasing smuggling routes and smugglers.
Italy seems to be one of the countries that had done a very good job, particularly in the Mediterranean, in the early part of this migrant crisis. What are conditions like now in Italy for migrants?
Italy is a brilliant country in terms of dealing with this situation. They had faced this situation for many years. So there is a functioning reception system in Italy. The situation today is the system is not really adapted to the needs of these people. So that's where we are working also in Italy, trying to do our best to improve the quality of the services. And one of the issues that we found there is a continuous emergency management mode. The reception system is not adapted to receive such a number of people every year, and actually it should be prepared to receive these people and provide for all their needs. So you have, for example, asylum seekers who are accommodated in emergency shelters, for example, warehouses or closed hotels, but there's no follow-up in terms of the provision of the services inside the places, such as medical care, mental health care, access to legal information. That's the main difficulty in Italy today.
I understand that in recent months there have been efforts to turn back, particularly many people from sub-Saharan and Northern Africa. Have you had any experience with the problems that people face when they're deported?
what we are seeing today is that there is clearly something happening with trying to differentiate amongst nationalities, which is quite worrying because protection needs and the right to seek asylum applies to everybody. I mean, it's not based on nationality. You can decide who can stay or not and who has the right to refugee status. What we're seeing today is that there is clearly a kind of a discriminatory approach that is happening in Greece, but also along the Balkan route. So certain nationalities are stigmatized like economic migrants and not allowed the same assistance and to the same path along the route. So, for example, people from North Africa are now detained when they arrive the island, while the others are let go after being registered. Certain nationalities, especially non-Syrian or non-Afghans and non-Iraqis, are not allowed to cross the border between Greece and Macedonia.
That was Arlie Ponthou of Doctors Without Borders talking to VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C. about their new report on migrants in Europe.
Demonstrations continue in Tunisia to protest mass unemployment in the country. The AP reports today that a police officer was killed when young protesters overturned his car in Farian. About 40 people are reported injured in violence between police and protesters in several cities. The protests follow the death Sunday of a job seeker in the Kasr Ain region. The young man was electrocuted after he scaled a transmission tower to protest his rejection for a government job. Unemployment averages around 15% in Tunisia, but is much higher outside of Tunis. The jobless rate for young people is about 30%. The suicide of an unemployed youth 5 years ago in Tunisia triggered an uprising that overthrew longtime ruler Zine El Abidine Ben Ali.
Coming up on 22 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Humans have a long history of warfare, but a new discovery shows it may be much longer than first thought. Cambridge University researchers have uncovered the site of a massacre in Kenya some 10,000 years ago. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
It is, in a sense, an ancient crime scene. About 30 kilometers west of Lake Turkana is a place called Netaruk. It's scrubland now, but about 10,000 years ago, Lake Turkana was massive and deep as the last ice age came to an end. Netaruk was a fertile lakeshore area populated by various hunter-gatherers, and they apparently did not always live in peace. Robert Foley is a professor of human evolution at Cambridge University and co-author of the study.
We have to make pretty difficult inferences from, you know, just a few scattered bones. I mean, this is, a murder mystery with a difference in that we don't know exactly who the victims are, as well as not knowing the culprits.
Foley says their work probably shares a lot in common with forensic scientists working today. Only the evidence they have is even more fragmentary and difficult. The first bit of evidence was discovered in 2012.
We found just beginning to be exposed on the surface, just a fragment of a skull. And excavation revealed that there was the complete skeleton. And the work over that year and subsequently showed us that there were, in the end, at least 27 individuals. Of those 27, many were very fragmentary, so we have hardly any skeleton to work with. But 12 were relatively complete. So our material is primarily those 12 individuals. We have the head, we have the limb bones, the arm bones, the ribs and things. So quite a lot of evidence.
And Foley says that evidence tells a tale.
So of the 12 that we can study in detail, it turned out that 10 of them had met violent deaths. And we know that in some cases because it was clear that the skulls had been crushed, hit with very heavy clubs or blows, so that parts of the frontal bones, where your forehead is, on one of them had been smashed in, and the hits on the jaw, and that had been broken. And so some of the individuals died literally clubbed to death. Others had projectiles, so small, you know, little bits of stone, obsidian, lodged in their skulls or found in the cavity of the skeleton.
The remains of at least 8 women and 6 children were found. Also, the remains of a 6 to 9 month old fetus were discovered within the abdominal cavity of one of the women. The position of her remains indicates her hands and feet may have been bound.
So this does look like a fairly ruthless event. Of course, we don't know about the ones that might have got away. So it could be that there was a larger group and some individuals managed to escape or indeed may have been captured and taken away as trophies, slaves, to join the other group.
Foley says the remains had not been buried. They lay where they died and gradually covered by dirt over time. It's not clear whether the site was an encampment that was attacked or whether the group was ambushed by a larger or more powerful group of hunter-gatherers. Researchers say that the Natterik massacre is the earliest record of intergroup violence among prehistoric hunter-gatherers who remained largely nomadic. And that's important because there's a view that such conflict did not become widespread until humans formed communities and farmed and stored food. That food was the reason to attack. Dr. Marta Mirazone-Lahr of Cambridge, who led the study, says the deaths at Natterik are testimony to the antiquity of intergroup violence and war. Professor Foley says that he has no doubt that it is in our biology to be aggressive and lethal, just as it is to be deeply caring and loving. He admits he's a bit of a philosopher.
What lies in human nature? What are we truly like? And one of the risks is that one can look at evidence such as Natterik, where we see the rather more unpleasant side of being human, and we might then want to read into that that we are a terrible species, that we do terrible things to each other, which is probably true. We shouldn't take it too far, because it's quite clear that for every act of warfare, there are probably many acts of altruism, sacrifice, living peacefully.
The Natterik find is just part of a much larger study of human evolution in Africa. Researchers hope to learn more about how early humans lived, not just how they died. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Microsoft founder Bill Gates visited Nigeria this week, where he collaborated with Africa's wealthiest man and the governors of several northern states on a new campaign to fight polio and other vaccine-preventable diseases. Chris Stein has more from Lagos.
The governors of four northern states gathered Wednesday in the city of Kaduna to sign memorandums of understanding with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Dangote Foundation of Africa's richest man, Aliko Dangote, along with the U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. The MOUs kick off programs that aim to raise childhood vaccination coverage to 80% by 2018. Gates Foundation country representative Mairo Mandara says Borno, Yobe, Sokoto, and Kaduna states were chosen because they have the greatest need. They joined Kano and Bauchi states, which renewed their pre-existing agreements.
If you look at the whole country, the lowest level of immunization are in these states where these MOUs are signed.
Mandara says vaccination rates are as low as 30% in some northern states. Under the terms of the agreements, the Gates and Dangote foundations and the state governments will split the cost of initiatives, like sending out teams to vaccinate children. Another goal is to prevent polio from re-emerging. Nigeria has not reported a case of the disease since 2014. The World Health Organization said last year polio was no longer endemic in Nigeria. But Mandara says there is still work to be done before the country can be declared polio-free.
We need to maintain the immunity of children, the herd immunity, so that when children travel to other areas, we don't import the disease and bring it back.
Kaduna State Commissioner of Health and Human Services, Andrew Jonathan Nock, says he believes the new programs will help the state reach 100% vaccination coverage.
So by the time we get this fully activated, which means what if you end up getting close to about 100% immunization in the respective local governments?
Mandara said she could not yet say how much would be spent on the new programs, as the state's needs are still being assessed. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more. Coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African music mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The AU expresses what it calls its fervent hope that serious peace talks will begin and that Burundi's government will agree to the deployment of peacekeepers. And a former senior commander in the Lord's Resistance Army appears before the International Criminal Court today. Coming up, we'll have music from Angola. And in our feature segment, sports betting has become one of the popular ways of earning a living for many people in Zimbabwe. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Spuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today in Rwanda.
Kim, the Democratic Republic of Congo defeated Angola Thursday 4-2 to book a place in the quarterfinals at the African Nations Championship football tournament in Rwanda. Remember, VOA football fans, this competition, also known as CHAN, is for locally based players in Africa. So top European-based stars like 2015 African Footballer of the Year, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang of Gabon, who plays for Borussia Dortmund in Germany's Bundesliga, are not eligible for CHAN. Playing in Butare in Rwanda's southern province, the Congolese jumped out to a 3-0 lead in the first half after goals from Nelson Munganga, Elia Meshack, and Jonathan Bolingi. Gelson pulled one back for the Angolans in the 76th minute. Too little, too late, though. Mervel Bokadi added a fourth goal for the DRC in the 82nd minute before an own goal from the DRC's Joel Kimwaki 2 minutes later wrapped up the scoring. Final score from Butare, the Democratic Republic of Congo 4, Angola 2. The Congolese now top Group B with the maximum 6 points from 2 matches, and they look forward to the quarterfinals at CHAN. Angola, which lost to Cameroon in its opening match, has no points. In CHAN action Wednesday, Cameroon and host Rwanda both posted victories, as we hear now from the VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Striker Zakari Yannick Krahire scored at the stroke of halftime to secure Ivory Coast's victory by a solitary goal against Morocco at the Orange African Nations Championships in the Amahoro National Stadium in Kigali, Rwanda, on Wednesday. Earlier on at the same venue, Rwanda edged Gabon 2-1 in the other Group A tie. Midfielder Ernest Sugira scored in each half for Rwanda as Aaron Salim Bupenza scored for Gabon in the second half. The victory strengthened Rwanda's position at the top of Group A with 6 points. What's more, Rwanda is the first team to secure a place in the quarterfinals. Ivory Coast lies second with 3 points, while Gabon and Morocco have 1 point each.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show, which you can hear Monday through Friday on The Voice of America.
Hey, g'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively Sunny Man on the Sunny Side of Sports, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoje here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brilafm.net. I tell you this, it's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
This sunny side of sports correction leading into Mark Ouma's report. I had Cameroon posting a victory on Wednesday at Chan. In fact, it was Ivory Coast. Ivory Coast defeating Morocco 1-0. In Rwanda. Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
David, let's go to England now. Top footballers from Togo, Nigeria, and Egypt in the news. The Togolese star, Emmanuel Adebayor. What's the latest with him, David?
Yes, Sonny. Our dear friend, Emmanuel Adebayor, he's been out of action for some time now. But according to reports from England, he's still earning £100,000 a week. That is a staggering sum. Basically, Spurs lost interest in Adebayor. There were problems about his commitment, about his attitude. So they cancelled his contract. But nevertheless, under the deal, they have to pay this £100,000 a week. So I think it's high time that Adebayor got back on the field. And the club, Sonny, that are interested in giving him a chance are Crystal Palace. Alan Pardew, their no-nonsense manager, has come out very strongly. He has said that he's dealt with some very troublesome players in the past and has succeeded, and he doesn't see any problems whatsoever with Adebayor. I must say, Adebayor, at his best, is a very powerful force. He's got this physicality, he's got this height, and he can score goals, and he's done very well in the past with Spurs when Tim Sherwood was the manager. But unfortunately, when Sherwood went, Adebayor's career just nosedived. So interesting news that, Sonny. My feeling all along was that Adebayor, sooner or later, somebody was going to be brave enough to give him a chance, and maybe it's going to be Crystal Palace. Palace say they're short of striking material, and it's going to be really interesting to see if this troublesome Togolese star can be reined in and if he can just concentrate on scoring goals. Odion Ighalo is somebody that crops up regularly on The Voice of America. He's Nigerian, and he's been a first-season sensation at Watford. Watford themselves were considered likely relegation candidates, but at the moment are comfortably placed in mid-table despite a post-Christmas slump. And Ighalo must take a lot of credit for that. He has scored 13 goals, and who knows, he may well be the answer long-term to the problems of the Super Eagles, who've lacked a consistent goal scorer for some time now. In tribute to his performances for Watford in December, he has received the Premier League Player of the Month award. That, to me, Sonny, is a fantastic achievement. It's really been a great year in England, specifically for Ighalo and also Riyad Mahrez, the Algerian at Leicester City. These guys have scored 13 goals each. They're right up there in the hunt for the Premier League Top Scorer award. Another African making news as far as the Premier League is concerned is Mohamed Elneny. He's been playing for Baal. He's an Egyptian, a striker, and he's now signed for Arsenal. And no doubt he'll be hoping to do as well as his compatriot, Mohamed Salah. He went to Chelsea, and then he went out on loan to several other clubs, and at the moment he's banging in the goals for Roma in the Italian top flight.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Oh, Africa. Africa!
is Africa. Tamina, mina, waka, waka, Tamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Ni chabulile. Hola.
Cause this is Africa. Tamina, mina, waka, waka, Tamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
They're playing back.
In National Basketball Association news, the reigning champion Golden State Warriors crushed the host Chicago Bulls Wednesday night, 125-94. It was the second big road victory in a row for the Warriors, who improved their league-best record to 39 wins and only 4 losses. On Monday night, the Warriors beat LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers by 34 points, trouncing the Cavs 132-98 in Cleveland, Ohio. In Chicago, sharpshooting guard Stephen Curry once again led the way for the Warriors. He had 25 points and also added 11 assists and 7 rebounds. Curry's backcourt partner Klay Thompson scored 20 points. Meanwhile, in Houston, Texas, Detroit Pistons center Andre Drummond put his name in the record books, and I think it's a record that Andre might not be too proud of. He set a new NBA record by missing 23 free throws in Detroit's 123-114 victory over the host Houston Rockets. Overall, Drummond was 13 for 36 from the free throw line, on a night when he was fouled 21 times. The previous record of 22 misses at the free throw line was set by the late, great Wilt Chamberlain way back in 1967. Elsewhere around the NBA, the Cleveland Cavaliers bounced back from that embarrassing loss to the Golden State Warriors. They defeated the Brooklyn Nets on Wednesday night, 91-78. Kevin Love had 17 points and 18 rebounds. Brooke Lopez had 16 points and 10 rebounds for Brooklyn. The Oklahoma City Thunder stormed past the Charlotte Hornets, 109-95. Kevin Durant scored 26 points for the host Thunder, who won their 6th game in a row. In New York City, the Knicks defeated the Utah Jazz 118-111 in overtime. Carmelo Anthony scored 30 points to help the Knicks triumph. And also in Canada, the Toronto Raptors defeated the Boston Celtics 115-109. DeMar DeRozan scored 34 points as Toronto beat visiting Boston for its 6th win in a row. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, a former soldier in the Sudan Army starts his own business. And next, sports betting, a popular way of earning a living for many people in Zimbabwe. But for some music, here is Danielle of Angola with Amatumba.
Cabelo postiço não lhe caiu, não sei pro que te insiste. Estilo do bem marado, mas até moça resiste. Boca, estilo surra, cara enfeitada tipo elele. Chega na disco, gingona, todos fogem da negra bué. Lá vem ela, bunda, corpo é corpo, esqueleto tipo em bandeira.
Chega bem rápido para cair na quizamba. Agarra matumba,
chama a polícia.
Para matumba,
chama a polícia.
Acalma matumba, quer a quizumba. Agarra matumba, agarra matumba,
chama a polícia.
Para matumba,
chama a polícia.
Acalma matumba, quer a quizumba. Agarra matumba. Grife do Rio de Janeiro, mas mesmo assim não tem jeito. Lente, luta contra dente. Que uso é de ferro. Dá-lhe nada, dá licença, tenta chegar no sapato. Pois mudou o penteado, aterra num afro marado. Lá vem ela,
a malaica,
candongueira,
a xaxeira,
feta gata, parte esqueleto. Desculpa, menina, se
Danielle of Angola with Amatumba.
In 2008, Dien Oruok Mabior, a former soldier in the Sudan Army, quit the service to start his own business, Shining Shoes, in Bor. He says he now earns enough money to raise his family. As Jacob Achiek reports, Oruok is making money in a business most South Sudanese shy away from starting.
A 46-year-old Dien Oruok has an obsession with laser. He says he loves polishing a nice pair of laser shoes. His shoes shining shop is usually crowded with people waiting to get their shoes polished by Mabior. Clients patiently sit their favorite South Sudanese tea as they wait their turn. Shoes China makes a plenty of money in Bor because residents love to have polished shoes in the dusty Bor market. Arog stay busy because he only charge a small fee for polishing their pair of shoes. Speaking in Dinga, Arog says he makes about 150 South Sudanese pound a day, so he can give his family about 50 pound for food and give the children about 600 South Sudanese pound a month for school. Arok says he loves his work because it is what he does to hand money for his family of five. Just 2 years after starting his shoes shining business, Arok has been able to help other residents of Bor as well. He says he used part of his saving to buy a large generator that supply electricity to shop owners in Bor market. Arok says when he saved £50,000, he went to Juba and bought a big generator and some other goods, then come back and construct a shop in Langbar and open a phone charging center. He says after the crisis broke out, everything was looted. His shop, which is usually open from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., saved around 70 customers a day. Arok pays 400 South Sudanese pounds a month to rent his job space. He encourages fellow Bor residents to compete with Ugandan and Kenyan, who he says does just about what kind of work to earn money in South Sudan. He says it's important to learn a skill like shoes shining because life now under the current government is not good. Arok says salaries may not be paid for 2 months, and the people may suffer. So it's important to know handwork. Dien Oruok left the army just a month after the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2005. He then joined a prison service department in 2006 under the ranks of Sergeant Major. In 2008, he quit his job at the prison department because his salaries was not enough to take care of his family of five. Arok decided to sell one of his bulls for 1,000 South Sudanese pound to have enough capital to start his shoes shining business. Arok says one day he hoped to buy a land and build his own shop. For VOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Bor.
Having endured over a decade of hardships as a result of our unrelenting economic crisis, Zimbabweans have developed a reputation of not just being resilient, but also innovative in how to get by. Sports betting has become one of the popular ways of earning a living for many people in the country. Correspondent Tawuri Shava reports.
About half a dozen men huddle together as they listen attentively to a horse racing commentary being broadcast on one of the big screen television sets in a popular betting place at Gweru's Mkoba 6 shopping center in the Midlands province. Among them is a man who chooses to identify himself only as Moyo and is one of the well-known regulars at this place. Moyo, in his early 40s, readily volunteers to talk about his experience as a horse racing punter. He says he detests betting as he believes it is immoral and reveals that he grew up with a father who used to squander most of his wages on gambling, which made him fail to take care of his family. But in an ironic twist of fate, Moyo admits he himself became drawn to betting on horses, which has been his regular source of income since the time he got out of formal employment in 1998.
When I was an adult, when I was already working, I would see people making money from gambling. When I started betting, I had a dream. I dreamt a race and its results. And then the following day, I went and betted. And the numbers just came as they appeared in my dream. Then I started believing, I said, I know this thing, I could make money and earn a living. Though I was working, because I had got a surplus amount.
Although it is often associated with gambling, sports betting is different in that it is regularized or controlled by law, while various forms of gambling are sometimes illegal. In Zimbabwe, the Gaming and Lotteries Act regulates the sports betting industry as well as other betting games like lotteries and casinos. Horse racing has for a long time been the only sport in the country on which punters could place bets, but in the past few years, several betting companies have been given licenses to operate bets on other sports like soccer, basketball, cricket, tennis, as well as dog racing. Although facts and figures are not readily available, there has been a rise in sports betting in the country, and in May, government announced it had stopped granting betting licenses to curb the upsurge of sports betting in the country. Sports betting and other gambling games like lotteries and casinos are often euphemistically referred to as games of chance. In Zimbabwe, however, they are no longer just games, but a means of survival for many owing to high unemployment. Moyo says it is not surprising that many young people are now among punters in sports betting.
When I grew up, all I knew is to know that horse racing gambling was for the retired people that would take their money as leisure doing gambling for leisure purposes, not solely to get money to survive. Because already they had made up their lives, they were spending their monies. But currently the situation in our country that we've got no employment, the industries, they are closed. These youngsters, after school, they have nowhere to go and work. Gambling is now the only option they are left with to look for money.
And the act of betting involves putting a certain amount of money or wager on the result of a sports game or race, and there are many types of bets that one can put their money on. Moyo says he likes placing bets on horses because he calls himself a veteran punter and understands even the most subtle details of the game. He, however, admits that winning, especially big amounts that matter, is never easy.
On some other days, I might be lucky to win, but on other days, I might have a streak of losing. I might even go for 4 days without even winning. That also will affect my family, because they'll be expecting only each and every day that I should bring them something. They actually know that I survive on gambling. Besides looking for money through peace jobs, but I solely survive on gambling.
24-year-old Neva Shoko has been involved on betting on soccer matches for the past 2 years. The unemployed youth says he gets money for betting from doing odd jobs and also donations from relatives and friends. Although, like most Zimbabweans, he is a keen follower of the English Premier League, Shoko says he prefers to bet on Italian, German, and Spanish leagues, which he says are more predictable. He places bets every weekend and says he's usually assured of winning once a month, and though paltry, the winnings enable him to buy himself food and clothes.
For a month, I use almost $4 to bet, because I bet every weekend using $1. So if I get $20, I make a profit. I buy food for myself and clothes, because now I'm not working and no one is supporting my family.
Like Moyo, Shoko believes that gambling is a vice which people should avoid, but he says in the absence of a more conventional way of earning a living, he has no choice but to be involved in sports betting.
It's true, but there is nothing we can do because of this economy. You have to do something even bad to get money.
While the sports betting industry may provide a means of earning a living for some, most of those involved in it say they prefer a more straightforward way and hope that the new year will bring a new lease of life for the country's economy. This is Taurai Shava.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Local communities are the key to turning the tide against terrorism. Whether in France, Turkey, or the United States, said Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell, militaries and intelligence agencies can protect us from external threats and bring terrorists to justice. But they cannot address the complex motives and hateful ideologies that drive people to terrorism in the first place. Real progress against terrorism requires not only eliminating terrorists, but also disrupting the process by which people become terrorists. Only a broader and more holistic approach can ensure that new recruits don't join the ISIL battlefield. The United States has promoted this broader approach to tackling terrorism at home and abroad under the mantle of Countering Violent Extremism, or CVE, which recognizes that empowered communities are among the best antidotes for preventing the spread of terrorist ideologies. The first step to implementing a holistic approach is to ensure that public officials at home and abroad uphold the rule of law and respect for human rights. When governments fail to protect, respect, and serve all their people, it creates openings that terrorists eagerly exploit. According to the Global Terrorism Index, 92% of all terrorist attacks over the last 25 years occurred in countries where state-sponsored violence, such as torture and political imprisonment, was widespread. Second, said Ambassador Sewell, public officials must build trust with local leaders and communities. From Afghanistan to Somalia to Colombia, research shows that when populations are marginalized and supporting institutions are absent, communities become more vulnerable to violent extremism. But when locals know what to look for and whom to call to protect friends and family from radical ideologies, and when they trust authorities to help them, those ideologies struggle to take root. As the terrorist threat posed by the Islamic State continues to grow, partnerships with Muslim communities at home and abroad are more critical than ever. As President Barack Obama has said, ISIL does not speak for Islam, and Muslims around the world are our greatest allies in debunking perversions of their faith. In the long run, the way to defeat groups like ISIL is to promote democratic values and strong communities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.